Today we're diving into health trends that aren't always as accurate. And disclaimer right at the beginning, I'm not an expert, but having spent now 4 years in a science degree, I feel that I have some knowledge on these background informations that are being promoted on different medias. So I wanted to address a few of those. If you haven't heard already of germ theory, it's basically the idea that germs cause diseases. But this theory only became popular in the 20th century. Before that, it was miasma theory. Now, this was essentially developed by the ancients, by Hippocrates, who was considered the father of medicine. And it was propagated all the way through the Middle Ages by Galen and other famous historical doctors, and basically talked about how the bad air caused diseases, which is true because the amount of germs and bacteria that would have lived in the air at that during those time periods very well will have caused diseases, but it was actually the bacteria and the germs, not the whole air itself. So in the 1800s, this is when that theory was prominent, and then along came a few incidents and a few doctors that slowly started to debunk this theory over the next 100 years. So Louis Pasteur was a French chemist and microbiologist. He did work on vaccinations in the 1850s. And then there was also the incident in London in the Thames River with Jon Snow. This is not the Jon Snow from Game of Thrones. This is a doctor, Jon Snow, a physician, who discovered the waterborne bacteria that caused cholera. It was an incident with the Thames River where half of a particular street got river from the upper end of the Thames, and the other side of the street got water supplied from the bottom end of the Thames River as it flows. And what was happening is that at the top end of the Thames River, the water was fresh and it was fine, so the half the street that got supplied by that company that was providing that water was fine. But the other half had a distinct number of cholera cases. So Jon Snow looked into the water and found that the factory, somewhere in the middle of these two points that water was being supplied from, was dumping out all of the chemicals into the water, and that was actually poisoning the water that was given to the other side of the street. This is a very simplistic explanation, but there is actually a commemorative water pump, which is at the Jon Snow Memorial and Public House on Broadwick Street in Soho in London. So that was cholera, and alongside of this was the development of germ theory by a bunch of other physicians and scientists. Another notable name is Robert Koch, who was a German physician, and he actually sort of worked on specific differentiations in bacterium for tuberculosis and cholera. He extended on Pasteur's work and a few other scientists' work into the 1880s, and then germ theory really took over. So that's how the theories of diseases develop. Now, there are groups of people who today still believe that you can't isolate these bacterium, you can't see bacteria, therefore, you know, it's not entirely trustworthy, which, you know, philosophically speaking, you can't fully prove or disprove anything. But as somebody who is very passionate about science and who trusts in science, I would say that these people fall into the same group as those who still argue that the earth is flat. Moving on from diseases affect your immunity. So there's been so many trends where people are trying to boost their immunity. And more than just improving your immunity when you're sick or somebody who is not severely immunocompromised, because normal immune boosters don't really help. But when you look at the body as a system, it rests at homeostasis, which is balanced. And if you're increasing your immunity too much, there are actually detriments that come from that. And there's a reason why they say that kids should be playing in dirt and it's not so bad if they put their hands in their mouth, because they need to build up a resistance. And a lot of allergies There's been increases in nut allergies and different gluten and lactose intolerances over the past couple of decades. A lot of this actually comes from an over-sanitized society. Now, of course it's good to clean your fruit and to wash away bacteria, not to get food poisoning and salmonella in different meats, but it is important to note that what people don't talk about enough is the other side of the coin, where you are getting actual harms from over boosting your immunity with different supplements, and you can become overly dependent on those supplements. So your actual immunity then becomes weaker. And if you don't have access to these supplements, you will then have issues if you do happen to get sick. Now, this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot more severe consequences of overstimulating your immunity, and that is in autoimmune diseases. Now, these aren't causal links. Autoimmune diseases such as MS and psoriasis are highly debated still what the causes of those are, but overstimulating your immune system can contribute to autoimmune diseases. There are certain genetic factors to consider, but it is important to note that with autoimmune diseases, your immunity turns on itself. So you have developed too strong of an immune system that it finds even like the slightest deviation within your own immunity to be problematic. And that can also lead to or contribute to, again, gotta say that it's not a confirmed cause, but it can increase your risk of certain cancers. It is important to balance out the amount of supplements that you're taking. And one thing with supplements that you get from the chemist just over the counter, like magnesium, zinc, they have omega-3 on all of these different variations specific for women and men and children and blah, 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 is that these are very concentrated forms and they're actually very hard on your kidneys. And that's why they say you shouldn't be taking more than a certain amount a day. But you also really shouldn't be taking these too often, like every day anyways, because of the reasons that I've previously mentioned, but also because it is really hard on your kidneys. They have to process all of these concentrated minerals and you can develop different infections from that. And another consequence to touch off of autoimmune diseases is also allergies. And that's the exact same thing. People who have allergies are often, as I said, it's increased over the past few decades. And a lot of it is linked with an over-sanitized environment, not enough exposure to foreign substances, and certain chemicals like peanuts are known to have very high concentrations of allergens compared to other types of nuts, which are actually included in legumes, but that's a bit too much detail for the sake of this information. But that's another caveat that you should be aware of when taking immune boosters and overstimulating your immune system, is that allergies can result. So another way that your immune system is stimulated is vaccines. Now, this is quite a hot topic at the moment, particularly because of the COVID vaccines and a strong community of anti-vaxxers. I think one point to make just specifically on COVID, though I don't want to go into too much detail because we'll be here for hours, but I do believe from some of the conversations that I've had and the things that I've read that the anti-vax community for COVID specifically are different to the normal or out of COVID times anti-vax community, because a lot of people who are resisting getting the COVID vaccination have had previous vaccinations. So I think it's a bit more of a political movement, but anyway, not getting into too much details. I like to use the metaphor of your immune system like an army. So what a vaccine essentially does, and again, not going to go into too much detail because it's very daunting and it takes years and years and years, way beyond even what I have studied, and it's highly technical. And so this is just a simple way to explain it if you don't know too much about macrophages and T cells and B cells. So your immune system can be seen as like an army. And what a vaccine does, it basically spreads a photo of an intruder or a wanted person throughout this army so they know what to look out for. With viruses, and including COVID-19, when you get this intruder come, you imagine like your army fighting an opposing army, which is the virus. Now, as you're fighting, you get a fever, you may get symptoms, you may not, but basically your army is losing a few men, that opposing army is losing a few men until the opposing army leaves, is defeated basically. And so you're left feeling a little bit weak, you've been sick, and then the virus leaves. Now your own immunity, it replenishes itself, but the virus army, it doesn't regain any of its men that it's lost. So when it passes to the next person, it's already a few men weaker. So that person assuming they have a strong immunity, will be able to fight a smaller army to what you had to fight. And that's essentially the principle of herd immunity. Now, of course, it's not exactly like this. There are a lot more complex measures to take into account, but this is a very simplistic overview for anybody wanting to know. So if you're seeing your own immunity as an army to fight this intruder, you would like to know as much about this intruder before it comes. The less surprised you are, it's like the least surprise attack you can get, the better. So a vaccine is basically an informant. It informs your army of what the opposing army is doing, what it looks like, how it enters, and those sorts of things. There's a bit of another complexity to note when you think about talking about retrograde viruses, and very basically, this is a virus that inserts itself into your DNA by going in reverse DNA replication. So maybe a bit confusing, don't want to go into too much detail, but what I want to say by this is that when you get tested specifically for COVID-19 or even other viruses, some of it may still be in your system and it may actually be part of your genetics, which doesn't mean that you are a virus and it doesn't mean that you're permanently ill and it's going to change your genetics. It just means that you have that memory of that virus. So whenever it comes around again, you're going to know it, but it's still going to come up on a test, which is why there have been issues with the PCR tests. So not moving into too much more detail about COVID, but vaccines are how we prep your army. And one of the biggest things with anti-vaxxers is that a vaccine isn't actually about you as an individual so much so as it's about society and about herd immunity. Because if your army is prepared more for an intruder, then you are more likely to weaken it more before it gets to people who are severely immunocompromised or who don't have the strength to fight off such a virus if they're the ones who get hit first. So when you're taking a vaccine, it's somewhat about you, but it's not just about you. It's actually about all of society. And I think that the argument about personal choice, yes, everybody should have a choice about what goes into their body, but this isn't just a consequence that impacts an individual. It's something that impacts the whole society that you live in. Now, I can just hear the backlash of all of the protesters, but that's my two cents. So moving on now to the same way how you can overstimulate your immunity, you can also overtest. This has been another set of issues that has arisen in the past couple of decades with improvement of x-ray machines, MRI machines, CT scans, blood tests. All of these different testing methods have improved and have become a lot more available to the public. But that also entails its own set of over-testing, people who become overly worried that something's wrong with them, and then they go and get a lot of x-rays and CT scans. I've had quite a lot of x-rays in my lifetime, and that is just because I was incredibly accident prone. So yay for me. But exposure to those radiations is harmful. Now, it's not saying that you're gonna die if you go get one x-ray, but it's also not saying that you should get 10 x-rays every time you have a pain in your knee. It's another aspect of popular medical advice that needs to be taken with a grain of salt. You need to consider how much you need to be tested. Physical testing, what they do for breast cancers, prostate cancers, when you have a colonoscopy, these routine checks have become less harmful than they used to be, and getting those done regularly is really important, particularly over the age of 35-40. But testing for different brain damage, particularly with MRI machines, it's not advised to be going and getting an MRI scan every time you bump your head. To sum up on overstimulation and overtesting, when you hear something or see something on social medias or even in the news, definitely take it with a grain of salt and try and have a look into what's actually meant by this, because a lot of headlines these days are a lot more clickbaity just because there is such an abundance of information and everybody wants to be heard. So make sure that if you're reading a headline, you do actually understand what it's trying to get you to do. And whilst Dr. Google isn't always the best answer, it is good to have a look at what other information is out there about that particular topic. One of the most confusing headline topics of interest is sleep and how to improve your sleep. And in a society where we have less and less time for everything, including sleep, how you can adjust your sleep has become such an important topic, but it's also become very confusing when you're trying to decipher all of the information out there. The whole point of sleep is to rest and recuperate and let your cells regenerate. And your brain is actually the most functional at night because it's using all of those autonomic nervous system to breathe and to repair cells, and it's using energy to digest and to heal, etc., etc. There is an issue with the recommended 7 to 9 hours of sleep for adults, because this is a very generalized number. And most people do fall into this category, but most people don't understand how individualized your sleep actually has to be. There are sort of two main parts to consider when judging how well or how badly you sleep. I want to start off by saying that the health detriments from undersleeping are exactly the same as when you oversleep. So that means that you're really losing both ways if you're undersleeping or if you're oversleeping. So solution is just to get the right amount of sleep. But that is way easier said than done. So back to those two factors that impact your sleep is first actually your brain functionality, and then how many hours of sleep you need. So with brain functionality, this actually refers to the time of day when you are most productive. That's where you get the differentiation between morning people and night owls, but this can be really hard when you have a rigid routine of going to work, going to school, when you have commitments throughout the day. So how you actually determine your functionality is when you feel most motivated. And I know this is really hard because you can have weeks where you don't feel motivated and then another few weeks where you feel really motivated all of the time. But figuring out a point in the day when you feel most awake and most alert, essentially where you can get the most work done, most output in least amount of time, should be an indication of when your brain is most functional. So you want to make sure that if you're a morning person and you know that you're going to be most functional if you wake up at 6 a.m. and work really hard until about 12, you can leave your easier tasks for the day after that. you want to make sure that you are getting the amount of sleep that you need to be able to wake up at 6 a.m. Personally, I spent a lot of time doing research at this. Part of it was for uni and part of it was just from personal interest. But I took a lot of time during the pandemic to develop a strong sense of what my body needs. I took time to figure out how many hours of sleep I function at best. The way that I did this was by the minute that I wake up, like open my eyes, I got out of bed. Even if my eyes hurt, even if I knew that I had only had a few hours of sleep, like 5 or 6, I got out of bed and I started to get on with my day and then observed how I felt later on in the day, which led to me establishing I need about 6.5-7 hours of sleep a night to function optimally. If I sleep 8 hours, I feel much groggier and much more tired throughout the day. Same if I sleep 6 or 5 hours. Now, determining this is a lengthy process and it is hard when you have commitments and a full-time job and kids and other distractions and things you need to do. It took me a long time and I did have nights where I didn't sleep quite so well and that wasn't representative of a normal how many hours of sleep I need, but I did eventually establish it. So the trick sort of with this is learning how to listen to your body. Everyone says you should just listen to your body for nutrition, for skin, for sleep, but how you actually listen to your body when in practice is a lot more difficult. So just taking mental notes of times of day where you start to crash, where you start to get snacky, where you feel like you want to go and do physical exercise or where you actually want to stay and take a nap. Taking note of these times in a journal can really help position how you can optimize your routine for you. So that's with sleep, that's talking about how you can optimize your brain functionality and the amount of hours that you're actually sleeping. The biggest truth debunking is that you cannot catch up on sleep. I'm sure some people have heard this before, but I know that a lot of people won't be aware of this, but you can actually never catch up on sleep. Now, this sounds really dramatic and really horrible, but if you have a couple of nights of sleeping less hours than what your body needs, you actually can't catch up on this by sleeping, you know, adding it to the hours that you sleep the next night. So the best thing is that if you happen to have a bad night, everybody has bad nights, that's standard. It's not, your body isn't fixed to have the perfect sleep every night, but you shouldn't be trying to catch up on this the next night. You should just be trying as best as you can to stick to the same amount of time sleeping and the same time waking up and going to sleep as close as you can. Again, if you're a shift worker and if you have different commitments at work or at uni, and then as well factoring in travel and jet lag, these sorts of things, all of that messes up your circadian rhythm. But if you try as best you can to stick to that same sort of pattern, you're more likely to get more good night's sleeps. And having a couple of nights of bad sleep here and there every couple of weeks is not going to exponentially increase your risk of cancer or heart disease, etc., etc. But it is good to try and have a good night's sleep as much as you can. I think that's basic knowledge, and I think everybody really wants that. To touch a little bit on routine as well, the reason that it's so advertised that productive people have a routine and they say, you know, the CEO routines where you wake up at 5 a.m., it's actually to do with your neuronal alignment. So in your brain, when you're born with many, many more millions of neurons than you need. And as you go through life, you develop in those first few years, you develop skills how to walk, how to stand, how to move your arm, fine motor skills. And the more that you practice these skills, the less neurons you need to accomplish those tasks. So those neurons are actually essentially killed in your brain. They're destroyed and they're removed. Now, when you get older, your neurons aren't so readily removed because your brain wants to preserve as many of them as it can. But when you have a routine, you're actually getting that sort of habit formation that reduces the amount of neurons needed to perform one task, like the thinking about the time that you need to get up in the morning, or when you need to go to bed, or what you do when you first wake up, and what you do when you go to sleep. These aspects of a routine, which are essentially habits, they form associations in your brain as well. So your brain knows that, you know, when you've got your pajamas on and you have pajamas that are distinct from your day clothes, your brain is saying to itself, okay, now it's time to sleep. So it starts to prepare itself for sleep more quickly than if you didn't have a routine. And with these extra neurons, you tend to use them for creative thinking and problem solving. And that's why they say that CEOs, you know, thrive off of routines, because they have all these extra neurons that are helping them with their creativity. Now, whether it's a causal link or not, that's also up for debate, but it definitely has been shown in lots of studies on routines that having these sorts of triggers can really improve your brain functionality. And another thing as well is with uniforms. That's why they have uniforms in the army and at school, because if you're spending less time thinking about what you have to wear, you have those neurons available to be focusing on what you need to learn or what you need to accomplish, how to think creatively, to solve problems creatively, etc., etc. One of the sort of positive side effects of having a routine is reducing the stress that comes with decision making. Even if it's not immediately apparent, having to make decisions causes a very limited amount of stress, but it is still what we would say is physiologically stressful. You get a tiny release of adrenaline and it helps your brain focus in to make a decision when it's at that very small concentration. But this stress, again, if the more decisions you have to make throughout your day, the more stresses that you have, it has all these different impacts, which leads nicely to talk about skin. Now, skin is another reason why people get their beauty sleep, in inverted commas, and getting stressed makes you break out and all these sorts of things. But some of the products that are advertised to help your skin actually have a slightly detrimental effect. Two of the most common advertised products in skincare are hyaluronic acid and niacinamide. So hyaluronic acid is, so everybody has endogenous hyaluronic acid, which exists in connective tissue membranes. It was originally used to treat osteoarthritis and also, interestingly, to develop fake tears for people that suffered with dry eye, which is where you actually can't make your own tears. So in terms of skincare, it's used as a dermal filler, and it's also used in surface, superficial skincare products because it does improve that connectivity, which all has to do with closing your pores and creating a protective barrier. Niacinamide is very similar. It's also called nicotinamide, and it is a form of vitamin B3. It treats acne because it has an anti-inflammatory effect, so it reduces the redness and the inflammation surrounding acne and acne scars. And it also stimulates keratinocytes and increases collagen production, which all act to improve the permeability of your skin and reduce the size of your pores. So these are the beneficial effects of these two compounds. However, it is very important to note the distinction in the dosage. It's been said that 500 to 1,000 milligrams of niacinamide can actually help to reduce certain skin cancers, again, because it increases the protective layer on your skin and the strength of your skin. But some products that advertise to contain either hyaluronic acid or niacinamide actually have such low concentrations that it would have essentially no effect on your skin. But because they include some amount of it, according to different legal patents and FDA approval, they can charge more. So that's something to always look out for, what the concentration is. And the other pitfall is if your skin is naturally quite good, you shouldn't be using too much of these products, because similar to what I was talking about before with overstimulating your immune system, you can overstimulate production of collagen and these different keratinocytes for your skin, which will be really bad, and it can cause different skin reactions and tightness and redness and eczema. So again, these products advertised can be really helpful, but should also take them with a grain of salt. So flagging that I'm not an expert on skin or dermatology or anything like that, simply speaking, to make this information accessible to everyone, your skin can become really sensitive to too many additives or products that you're adding to your skin. With general skincare, unless you have severe acne, especially if you're a teenager, you're hormonal, even in menopause, you can get pimples. You shouldn't be doing too much to your skin or combining too many different types of products. The main kind of steps that are important is when you're cleansing, to make sure you're cleansing thoroughly enough, and then you're putting on different, if you like to use certain products, that you're putting them on in layers that actually will work in the right order. So with cleansing, there's been a very big popular uptake of these electric cleansing brushes. Now, overusing these is actually quite detrimental because it does take off dead skin cells and dirt and oil that, if left on your skin for too long, can cause acne. But if you're using it too much, like every day, you can get actually more redness, and you can be scraping away some of that healthy skin and some of that healthy collagen that lies there. So another thing that you need to be careful of with a balance. That's why when you're doing your nightly skin routine, it shouldn't consist of too much. You should only be doing an intense facial, in inverted commas, a couple times a week, if that. So cleansing is one thing. A simple foam cleanser or any type of cleanser that you use should get all of those bacteria and oils and dead skin off of your face. And then when it comes to what you're actually putting on your skin, putting on moisturizer first is a really good base because, first of all, it absorbs directly into the skin, so it stops you from getting dry skin if you're prone to that. And it helps balance the absorption of any products that you put on top of it, because at the same time as helping those products sink deeper into the skin, it also has a sort of barrier between getting as like a raw product to the core of, say, your pores or that like initial layer. So moisturizer acts a bit of as a protective layer and also draws in any products you put over the top a bit deeper. Another thing to be wary of in a similar sense with makeup is what you're putting on your skin before you put on makeup. So most people use a primer, which is a really good way to protect your pores from getting clogged by foundation and to protect your skin with an extra layer so that foundation doesn't go directly onto it. However, again, using a simple moisturizer is sometimes more effective than a primer, because often what they put in primers can have subsets of silicones and substances that are actually harmful to your skin in themselves. So you could be clogging up your pores with substances that aren't actually good for your skin. So even using a simple moisturizer, it helps protect, adds as a protective layer, and it does fill up your pores enough that your makeup won't cause such a reaction. I always recommend with skin, less is more, and using the things that directly touch your face, have those of better quality. So having a nice quality foundation, anything you put over the top of that, you've already got, you know, a couple of protective layers if you use a primer or a moisturizer, so that isn't as important. But having a good quality foundation can really help if you tend to react. The last thing that I want to touch on with skin is about sun safety. In Australia, we deal with a lot of sun damaged, strong sun. We have high rates of different skin cancers. So how we protect our skin is important, and generally having a sunscreen on underneath your makeup is a good idea. But even for other parts of exposed skin on your arms and legs, and when you go to the beach, using sunscreen is really important. One fun fact, this might not be so fun for people who happen to have fallen prey to it, but a lot of aging products, the only difference between the aging version and the normal version is the added sunscreen, because sunscreen adds an extra protective layer, helping your skin stay young, and it also makes your skin look kind of glossy when you use it, which is sort of associated with youthfulness and such. So that's something to look out for as well. If you're looking at aging products, whether there are actual benefits to stimulating your collagen production, which decreases as you get older, or whether it is just added sunscreen. With tanning as well, there has been a big shift away from natural tanning because of that sun damage, particularly in Australia, to fake tanning. But fake tanning itself has caveats. If you're going to a salon and you're lying in a tanning bed, you are exposing yourself to a small level of radiation. And this isn't directly harmful, but used over time, it can actually contribute to increased risk of cancers and neurodegeneration, etc., etc. So that's one thing. Although tanning beds have come quite out of fashion, more so there is now spray tanning and different tanning scrubs, do it yourself at home. Again, with these, you are adding chemicals to your skin, so being aware of the brands and the particular products that work for you is good. There's not a lot of harm in it, but the best sort of version of fake tanning are the gradual tanners, because they have just a tint that is absorbed with your moisturizer, so you're still treating your skin nicely, you're still moisturizing it, but there is that gradual tan in there, so it does make you look a bit more naturally glowy and like you've been in the sun when you don't have to have that much sun exposure. Going back to everything is needs to be balanced and needs to be taken with a grain of salt. Having a natural tan and being exposed to sun radiation isn't harmful. It is good for your skin because it stimulates your melanin production, which is good for your bones. Vitamin D is actually the best source of calcium, which is surprising, but the mechanism by which it's converted gives you stronger bones, and that's why it's associated with health. But this is still another thing to be aware of that needs to be balanced. That brings us to the end of today's episode, where we got into med advice. Hopefully you learned something, and I'll talk to you next time.